Just coming to the end now of the qualities of the Buddha, we've just been seeing how he is the incomparable leaders of tameable persons. And we now come to the last one, a teacher of gods and humans. So we've just been talking about how the Buddha is the kind of the supreme teacher. And here, on top of that, you get the idea that not only does he teach human beings, he also teaches the gods. And of course, that is, it kind of makes sense, because when you read the suttas, it is obvious that we're talking about all kinds of devas and brahmas and all kinds of things. And why shouldn't he teach those beings as well? But one of the important, I think, implications of that is that sometimes when people, you know, maybe have some kind of a glimpse of these gods or whatever, they are kind of very much in awe of seeing something very unusual. That's what often happens when you see something special. But from a Buddhist point of view, just because you happen to be a god doesn't mean that you are anything special, right? Okay. It's a very different idea from most religions. Okay, you're a god. Okay, nice to meet you. Okay. That's kind of the Buddhist attitude to gods. Just because you happen to be reborn in a happy location doesn't mean you have any particular wisdom. And this is the idea here, that the Buddha is kind of, he stands above all of that because he has realized something which is a universal truth applicable to everyone and everybody wherever you are. And this is kind of what this is about. There's a nice passage one in somewhere in the suttas. Where is this again in the suttas? I think it is, where is it? I can't remember now where it is. It's somewhere in the suttas, and there is a person who has, that's right, I think it's in the Sakkapanya Sutta, the questions of Sakka. And Sakka comes down to the Buddha to meet the Buddha, right? And then the Buddha asks Sakka, first of all, well, have you met any other teachers before you came down to visit me? And Sakka says, yeah, I went to all of these other teachers, and that's kind of standard group of six teachers that we had a look at before. And the Buddha said, well, what happened when you met them? Well, what happened was that they were so overawed when they saw kind of the brilliant light and everything. They were so overawed that instead of me becoming their disciple, they became my disciples, and they bowed down to me, right? And this is what happens to most people. Imagine if you saw some kind of brilliant light, enormous light, so powerful, and it came down to you and had this beautiful voice, right? And said to you, I am God. What would you say? You say, oh, scared. You wouldn't know what to say, right? You would feel completely out of your depth, basically. But the Buddha says, just because something is amazing and astonishing doesn't mean that there is any wisdom behind that. It just means that there are these astonishing things in the world, but there is nothing much, you know, real Buddhist wisdom behind that. That's an important thing to keep in mind, because there are sometimes we do kind of have access to some of these phenomena, and sometimes we see these kind of things. And of course, in India, in that time, in those days, just like India now, when you go to India, people worship all these gods. Everybody has their own personal god, right? Ganesh and Vishnu and Kali and whatever it is. And one of the things about this particular formula, of course, is to say that when you say this to the Indian population at large, who may no longer be Buddhist, you're kind of setting a hierarchy in a sense. You're saying that, well, actually, the Buddha is actually above all of that. So it has a kind of inclusiveness, right? That they kind of almost like the all the Hindu gods and Hinduism is kind of included in under Buddhism, and the insight of the Buddha is universal and includes all of those gods and all of that stuff at the same time. It's kind of laying down a claim at the same time if you are not a Buddhist yourself, and that's probably what you will hear in those words. So the Buddha is teacher of gods and humans. And then again you have enlightened. This is, in this case, it is, what is the word in this case? It's probably just Buddha. It's Buddha, that's right, of course. Buddha. And then the last one is Bhagava, which here is translated as blessed. And Bhagava just means Lord, essentially. Anyone in India, if you claim to be somebody special, you say you are a Bhagava. And all the gods in India, they're all Bhagavas, right? They're lords. And this is kind of the standard kind of way to address yourself if you're going to be taken really, really seriously as a spiritual teacher. Some of these Bhagavas are really dodgy characters, but they're kind of trying to lift themselves up by giving themselves special epithets and that kind of stuff. So there you are. That is the Buddha and the various qualities of the Buddha for you. And just to remind you again, these are the kind of things that you think about when you think about the Buddha. These are the things that kind of tell you something about the Buddha, his insight, his understanding, why he is such an important teacher. This is where the inspiration should come from. And so this is then about right view arising in the world. Some of the things that we're talking about here is precisely that kind of right view. The Buddha comes into the world, the right view becomes available. Right now we have right view. And of course, once that right view is there, the Buddha has arisen. The next thing that arises is the Dhamma, is the spreading of that right view to other people. The Buddha realizes that he has an important message to share with the world. And because he has that important message, he wants to share that. So he starts teaching these things. And this is what the next little passage here is about. He declares this world with its gods, its Maras, and its Brahmas. This generation with its recluses and Brahmins, its gods and its people. You can see sometimes I change the translation a bit because I don't really agree with the translation here. So gods and its people rather than princes, which he has himself realized with direct knowledge. He teaches the Dhamma, good in the beginning, good in the middle, and good in the end, with the right meaning and phrasing, and he reveals a holy life that is utterly perfect and pure. So, declaring the world, right, it means that he declares not just the visible world, but everything that is possible, the whole gamut with its gods and everything. So this is when the Dhamma becomes known. The Dhamma is much more than what is just visible to ordinary people. So he declares that the Dhamma becomes accessible to everyone. And as it says, this is at the end of that sentence, that he has realized with direct knowledge or with direct insight, if you like, that of course is the important point here. He's declaring something that he has seen with his own eyes. This is kind of the important issue. And then you have all these things, right? He declares this world with its gods, its Maras, and its Brahmas. And what is all that about? Why does he say these things? And the answer again is pretty much, I think, exactly what I was talking about just a minute ago. The idea that the Maras and the Brahmas and the Devas, these were important parts that already existed in India at the time. These were already part of the Indian spiritual vocabulary. These are the kind of things that the Brahmanical teachers would have talked about, or other spiritual teachers would have talked about, right? So now the Buddha is saying, well, I have seen all of this. I know what the real Brahmas and Maras are. I have insight into these things. And again, there's this idea of other religions kind of falling in under Buddhism, because you have realized basically what all of these other teachings also are referring to when they talk about these things. So it is kind of this idea is called inclusivism, apparently, in kind of religious academic scholarship. Inclusivism in the sense that you include the other religion inside your own and putting yourself up as the kind of umbrella teaching. The Hindus tried to do the same thing with Buddhism, right? They said the Buddha is just the reincarnation of Vishnu. So Buddha is just the reincarnation of Vishnu. Okay, that means that Buddhism becomes part of Hinduism. So kind of this is the competition, right? So who's going to win this competition in the end? That's the question. And of course, nobody wins. Everybody just loses out, unfortunately. But that's the reality of these things. So you have seen again, and this, of course, refers back to all the things we have just seen before. The idea of being a Loka Vidu, somebody who has understood the world, who has seen the world. This is what refers back to her. This is another way of saying exactly the same thing that we've been looking at before. And then, so seeing all the Maras, the Brahmas, the Devas, this generation with its recluses and Brahmins. So he declares this generation with its recluses and Brahmins. What does that mean? declares, it's kind of not much need to declare it, they're right there in front of you, right? So what are you actually declaring here? And I think the idea here is that what you declare is that you declare their doctrine. You understand their doctrine. You understand the limitations of their doctrines, the good sides of them, and you see them in relationship to the Buddhist doctrine. Right? And this is one of the things that the Buddha does sometimes in the suttas. You see, the Buddha talks about these various other doctrines, and he talks about whether they are useful or how dangerous they are and all of these kind of things. So he has understood all of these things in their context. He knows the limitations and the of all of these other teachings in India at that time. So this is a bit like understanding philosophy in a sense, right? But again, all through direct personal experience, both of the Brahmins and of other recluses. It's princes and its people, which really should be Deva Manusanangs, the gods and its people, that he has realized himself with direct knowledge. He teaches the Dhamma, good in the beginning, good in the middle, and good in the end. And this is can be interpreted in many different ways, what that actually means. But the general idea is that when you practice the Dhamma, you start to get benefits straight away, right? There are good things happening. Majority of people say that when they start practicing the five precepts, for example, they start to feel better about themselves, right? Straight away, you get a little bit of boost. You feel more relaxed, perhaps, or you feel a bit more kind of self-esteem, a bit kind of more sense of integrity about yourself. You feel more at ease, perhaps, in other people's company because you know that you're living in the right way and all of these kind of things. So straight away, you gain some benefit from doing these things in the right way. And of course, in the middle, and in the middle then often has to do with meditation practice. And if you meditate properly and you gain some results of that meditation practice, of course, it's good in the middle as well. So you kind of gain that happiness and joys of samadhi or whatever it is. Then in the end, when you have the wisdom and the insight, the understanding of these things, again, it is beneficial. It takes you further down, even further down the road, even more happiness, right? Sometimes we talk about Buddhism being happiness upon happiness upon happiness. That's really exactly what it is. It is the movement towards more and more happiness is really what the Buddha's teaching is about. A continuous reduction in suffering is part of that. So good in the middle, good in the beginning and the end, with the right meaning and right phrasing. And the right meaning here is the atta, that is like the goal of the path. You're moving, it has the right or a good goal, right? So the goal is kind of is good. In other words, the idea of nibbana is a very positive state. Sa-attang, right meaning, and the right phrasing as well. And this is one of the things that I always find interesting about the suttas, that the phrasing actually matters. The way the Buddha has laid down the suttas is with great care in terms of consistency, in terms of how things kind of cohere together into a great whole. Each little teaching may be seen as one little piece of a jigsaw puzzle. But when you put it all together, it all becomes this beautiful picture that hangs together very nicely. Every phrase matters. Every word is there for a reason. Nothing is superfluous. Nothing is really lacking, right? This is one of those remarkable things about the teachings. The phrasing is actually very important itself. Now, of course, you could argue that after 2,500 years, maybe some of the phrasing has been a bit corrupted. So how can we know that this still is the case today? The interesting thing, of course, is that a lot of the phrasing that is there after 2,500 years still is probably very much the same as it was 2,500 years ago. It is hard to really understand how that can be the case, because it sounds almost incredible that should be the case. But we know that because we can compare again the Pali text with the Chinese, with the Sanskrit sources, and remember that these different sources, they separated the ways around the time of Ashoka. That's almost 2,300 years ago, right? They went their separate ways. And even though they have been going separately for so long, perhaps even slightly longer, it's very hard to know exactly when they separated. But despite that, when you compare them today, when you kind of translate, when you look, if you can read, if you are one of these geniuses who can read everything, ancient Chinese, Pali, Sanskrit, Tibetan, English, German, French, Italian, Russian, right? There's some people like that who can, just incredibly good with languages. So, if you can read that and you compare it, you see that these things, sometimes they are almost word for word exactly the same after 2,300 years. And not always, but sometimes they are. For example, one example is the jhana formulas. The formulas for the jhanas, especially the first and second jhana, are exactly the same. Whether you read it in the agamas in Chinese or you read it in the Pali or whatever, exactly the same. In the third jhana, I think there's one word which is slightly different. It doesn't really make any difference for the meaning, but it's slightly different. And I think the fourth jhana is exactly the same again. So this is what you find with some of the core teachings, that they have been preserved with incredible care, right? This would have been the Sangha who preserved these things almost from the very beginning, and they would have had a sense of being very conservative, great care in looking after these teachings, because they knew that the actual wording was very important. And the Buddha says so himself in certain suttas, that this should be preserved by chanting together, you know, word for word, getting the wording right and all these kind of things. So it's kind of to be expected. So the wording very often matters. The wording is carefully chosen. And that is one of the reasons that makes it interesting to look at the suttas in quite a bit of detail, because you get more out of it when you do that. Okay, so wording, both the wording and the meaning that the wording is pointing to, the actual results of the practice, all of these things are right. And he reveals the holy life. Holy life is the brahmacharya, the Brahma conduct, right? The brahmacharya that is utterly perfect and pure. And pure is not correct, it should be perfect and complete is actually a better translation. I think pure is correct. How does the Pali go again now? Paripunnang, parisuddang. Perfect, that should be complete, and pure can actually stay as it is. Utterly complete and pure. The idea of complete, of course, is that there is no factors missing on the path. All the factors that you need are actually there. So the suttas are enough. If you think that you need more than the suttas, then the chances are perhaps that you might end up going a bit astray, because the suttas themselves are sufficient, says the Buddha. It's one of those interesting things, right? The further away you go in history from the time of the Buddha, as we saw before, the less arahants there are. The closer you are to the time of the Buddha, especially the early period, the more arahants and the less rules. The further you go away, the less rules and the more rules, and the less arahants. So it is strange, because as time goes by, you get more suttas, more Abhidhamma, Mahayana suttas, commentaries, sub-commentaries, Visuddhimagga, piles and piles, meters and meters of book, and for every book, there's one less arahant in the world, pretty much, right? It's almost like that. It's kind of, it goes down, the number of arahants goes down, the number of books goes up. And this is kind of one of those scary little things. Every time you see a new book being advertised, oh, dangerous, and this is probably going in the wrong direction. So it is already perfect what you read in the suttas. We need to go back to basics much more. That is really what we need to do. And then there is a chance that we will make more progress. And the path really is quite simple. It's not all that complicated. It can be summarized very easily. And we'll see more about that very, very soon. That part, and then we can move on to the next paragraph. A householder or a householder's son or one born in some other clan hears that Dhamma. On hearing that Dhamma, he acquires faith in the Tathagata. Possessing that faith, he considers thus, household life is crowded and dusty. Life comfort is wide open. It is not easy while living in a home to lead the holy life, utterly complete and pure as a polished shell. Suppose I shave off my hair and beard, put on the ochre robe, not the yellow robe, the ochre robe, and go forward from the home life into homelessness. So, we have now seen how the Buddha arises in the world, then the Dhamma comes as a consequence of the Buddha, right? Because he starts teaching. And here, what we're seeing now is the beginning of the Sangha. Somebody hearing those teachings and deciding to go forth into homelessness. That's the beginning of the monastic Sangha that we're seeing right there. And now we can see how right view moves from the Buddha, and it moves from the Buddha onto other people. This is what is happening here with this person. And when he hears that, and he hears the Dhamma, and he acquires right view, then the right aim arises. Samma Sankappa, right aim or right purpose. He wants to go forth, right? This is a kind of right aim. He wants to practice the path fully. And this is what he's saying here. It is not easy while living at home to lead the holy life utterly perfect and pure. He wants to practice the path to its absolute maximum capacity. And this is the right aim, right purpose that happens inside of this person, whether it is a nun or a monk. And then once the right aim and purpose is there, you become a monastic or you are a lay person who practices seriously, then the rest of the path comes from that, and we'll see that very soon, what happens from there. So, but before we come to that, a householder or householder's son, or one born in some other clan, so householders in those days, these were the establishment, these were the important people in Indian society that carried Indian society forward. A householder was the head of a household, and a household at that time would often be very large households. You have everybody in the family living together, three or four, or maybe five generations, right, with lots of children all kind of running around, and of course all kind of workers and servants and slaves even they had in those days, and they probably would have maybe a business, maybe they would be farmers, so they would have farmland, and of course many people working on that, so they would be quite large, right, large households that we have at that time, and the householder was the head of that household. This was like the establishment in those days, the kind of the important people in society. These were the people who would go to the community hall and decide on things when they had like democratic decisions being made, right? The Sabha. The Sabha is the ancient Indian word for the assembly hall. And the Indian parliament today, what is it called? Sabha. Same word, right? Again, you read it in the suttas, and then you see it in India today. Still exactly the same. Nothing has changed. India, eternal culture. It's interesting, right? It's kind of nice. And of course, the Indian flag, which has the kind of the Ashokan capital on it, you know, all of that. You can see the connections there between Buddhism and ancient India and all of these things. So these were the upholders of Indian society, either the householder or the son of the house. The son would be the next one coming up behind the father, right? Who would then be the one who would go forth next. And of course the point here is that even those who were the upholders of Indian society, they would go forth. These were the ones who were educated. These were the ones who had the ability, perhaps more than others, to really understand these teachings, because they had an overview and they had heard many teachings from many different places. Then knew what was going on. So that's why these are the ones who were the first ones often to go forth. And then it says, or some other person born into some other clan. So this is like everybody else, right? They would also go forth, but the householders were like the crucial ones, the most important ones at that time. And this is what you find when you read the suttas. You find a lot of the monastics come from the higher kind of caste in society, the Brahmins and the Kshatriyas or Kattiyas, as it's called in Pali. They would come from them. But there were also very ordinary people as well who became monastics. So there was a bit of both. So you can see there's a nice mixture in the Sangha in that sense. And of course, those castes and clans, they disappeared once you became a monastic. Once you were a monastic, you were a monastic according to your seniority. There was no caste structure or class structure within the Sangha itself. And unfortunately, today, you do find within the Sangha, sometimes you find the kind of class structures. There's one of the Nikayas in Sri Lanka, which only accepts people from one caste, right? From the higher caste, not from the lower ones. And I think that is really quite bad, and it really kind of detracts from how the Buddha would have taught these things, would have accepted everybody, and we have kind of reverted back to some of the bad habits of old, when we kind of exclude certain people in that way. When it comes to the Dhamma, what makes you a person of quality is your virtue, is your kindness, not whether you're born in some kind of high or low family. Anyway, so they go forth, right? And on hearing that Dhamma, you acquire faith in the Tathagata. You look at the Tathagata, you see the qualities are there. You hear the Dhamma matches those qualities, right? You think, whoa, this is it. This is what I've been looking for all along. Too much suffering in life. Here is the chance to escape from all that. And possessing that faith, he considers household life is crowded and dusty. I like that that little phrase, crowded and dusty. So is that right? Is it dusty? Is that somewhere? Yeah? So it crowded. I can imagine, especially in those days, it would have been crowded. But the idea, of course, is that when you live in a household life, you live quite close together compared to when you are a monastic. And when you live close together, it causes all kind of problems, right? Frictions and problems and attachments and all of these kind of things. It's very easy to go a little bit on one another's nerves, right? Because you are so close together all the time. And it's a very different feel when you become a monk, right? When I'm finished here every day, I disappear into my room very quickly, right? After I've been talking for the hour, and I can just hang out by myself. And I love that being by myself. It's really nice, because when you're by yourself, you kind of withdraw from that interaction all the time. This is also one of the great things about living in my kuti when I'm in Bodhinyana Monastery. It's like you withdraw from other people. It's like you it's mentally very light, mentally very easy. It's like you withdraw a little bit from all this pulling of, you know, all the time we're kind of manipulating each other a little bit. All these attachments, the things that are happening. You withdraw from all that and you can kind of breathe. Right? And it's actually very nice. It's psychologically, it's very beautiful when that happens. And it's very different from living in a household life. I know when I go back and visit my parents, I usually go back and visit my parents usually once a year these days, and I stay with my parents for about 7 days. And it doesn't take that long before you kind of fall a little bit into that pattern of what things were like before, right? You are the son, they are the parents. Actually, I have a very good relationship with my family. It's not really a problem at all. But you can see the difference, psychological difference, where there is attachments, where there's a little bit of manipulation, where there's a little bit of kind of... there is all of these kind of things. And the psychology is actually quite different. You feel a sense of freedom when you live apart in this way. That means that there is less ability, when there's no attachments there, or less attachments, there is the mind is more even, right? It's not being pulled about so much by all of these things, how we treat each other. And that is actually a very nice thing. And the idea of dusty is a very similar kind of idea. In the suttas, the idea of the dust is the idea of passions, right? Passions getting aroused, both in the negative sense, in the sense of being upset, but also in the kind of sense of attachment and all of these kind of things. We always have the interaction, always gives rise to all of these defilements arising in the mind when you live too close together with people. So people is always both the things that delight us a lot, but also a source of problems, right? This is one of those things in the world. There was one of those famous European philosophers, I think the French philosopher Sartre, Jean-Paul Sartre, you probably heard of him, an existentialist philosopher. He lived, he died in the 1960s, something like that. And he defined suffering once. His suffering was defined as other people. That was his definition of suffering here. So a little bit Buddhist sentiment there. So when you realize the problems of the household life, that it is has these problems to it, and then life gone forth is wide open. It's psychologically wide open. You feel a sense of liberation just by living apart. The mind becomes more even. You have more ability to see things clearly, more vipassana, more samatha, more calm, just because you get a slight separation from things, right? That is one of the beautiful things about monastic life. I was talking about other aspects of monastic life yesterday, the idea that you are with like-minded people who think in the same way, that is another very beautiful benefit. But another benefit is precisely the opposite, that you are away from people, right? This is the other benefit of monastic life. So, then he thinks, it is not easy while living in a home to lead the holy life, utterly perfect, utterly complete, thank you, and pure as a polished shell. Right? It is not easy precisely because of these things. And that, of course, is exactly why the Buddha lays down the monastic life. It is there for a reason. It is not something that is just randomly kind of suggested because it kind of sounds cool or whatever. That's not really good enough. It's got to be useful. And the Buddha says elsewhere in the suttas, it talks about the different fields, the extent to which they have yield a lot of crop or not. And the best field is always the monastic field, because that is where people are fully committed and they live this life that is more secluded and more away from the world. That is the ideal anyway of monastic life. Often it doesn't reach quite that ideal, but sometimes it does, and then it becomes very useful for practicing the path. So important to remember that, right? Remember that the Buddha laid this down for a reason. There is a reason why there is a monastic life. And now, in many often, like in Sri Lanka, it was very common. I think maybe it's changing a bit now. It was very common, you know, you had maybe three sons and a couple of daughters, right? And then maybe one of the sons really smart. Okay, send him off to university. He does a university degree. The second one, he was smart enough, so send him off to do some kind of vocational training. But the third one, he was a real dum-dum, right? Okay, send him off to the monastery. He can kind of become a monk. Yeah. Right? You wouldn't want to waste a talent on the monastery here. And this is exactly the wrong way of thinking, right? It should be the other way around. The guy who goes to university, he's the one who should be sent to the monastery, because that is where you learn the really profound things about life. That is where you learn about the end of suffering. The other stuff, actually, is just superficial by comparison. It's like getting things really the wrong way around. So when monastic life is really well lived in the right way, it is something extraordinarily powerful and beautiful that really has the ability to help happen and reduction of suffering in the entire world. That's why the Buddha lays it down. That's why we should rejoice in that and support that to the best of our ability. So, then he decides, so then he says, suppose I shave off my hair and beard, or if you are a nun, it's sufficient to shave off your hair. And you put on the ochre robe, and then you go forth from home life to homelessness. So you put on the robe of a monastic, that's what it means by ochre robe, and you go forth into homelessness. Homelessness is interesting. What exactly does that mean? And it can mean different things. One of the things it means is that you, even if you have a kuti where you stay most of the time, it's not your kuti. It belongs to the sangha as a whole, so you have to move at the moment's notice. Or it can also mean somebody who is just wandering all the time, who doesn't really stay put anywhere very long. Either one of those things is meant by the idea of homelessness. Then, on a later occasion, abandoning a small or a large fortune, right? You give up all your possessions. This is one of the things that you see here at the very beginning of the monastic life. You give up all your possessions. But for many people, it's kind of scary to give up everything you know. What if you don't make it in monastic life, right? And it's fair enough. It is a bit scary, because usually people disrobe, usually is it at the beginning of the monastic career that they disrobe. So very often what we do at Bodhinyana Monastery, we say, okay, for 5 years, you kind of, either you keep the belongings yourself, or you put them together, you give that to your family or whatever, and they can look after them. And that is always a nice way of doing it anyway. You give all your belongings away to your family members, and they can then keep them and do whatever they wish with those belongings. You don't have to worry about it. And should you disrobe, there's always something to come back to afterwards. So, but the idea is to kind of get rid of all of that stuff. You don't have to worry about it. It's very nice not to own very much in this world. It's very light. We will see a very beautiful passage on that as we come down further down here. There's a certain lightness, unburdenedness of mind. The mind becomes light when there's very few things to look after, right? This is kind of part of the point here. So you try to get rid of as much as possible. And part of the thing that you also give up, you leave, abandon a small and large circle of relatives, right? Oh, that is also quite scary. And this is why sometimes you don't become very popular with relatives. If somebody wants to go for it and say, oh, can I please go for it? Yes, you can. And then the relatives come and want to take him or her back again because they're not ready to give up their child or whatever. But remember, it is not an absolute abandonment, right? It's not as if you never see your relatives again. I try to go back and visit my parents once a year these days, at least for a few days. And because I think that is only reasonable thing to do. And usually it is usually very, very beneficial when you do that, because after a while your parents and your family start to realize that you're actually doing something useful, and then that relationship kind of gets turned around and it becomes a very nice and beautiful relationship as a consequence of that. So it is important as a monastic. This is one of the things that we have in the Dhamma, this idea that it's important to look after your parents especially, but also your family in a broader context, and important to take that seriously, even if you are a monastic, and not just abandon them too much. So this is one of those things that I think matters in this world. There's that beautiful story of Ratapala that I'm sure you've heard about, that is quite kind of extreme, where Ratapala decides to go forth, and he says to his parents, parents refuse him to go forth, right? And he lies down on the ground and says, I will either die right here or you will give me the going forth. And after he starts to get really thin and miserable, his parents say, okay, maybe we better let him go forth. It's a very nice story. Majjhimanikaya 82, and a very nice story to read if you don't know that story. So that is the... That part of it. And then once he does that, he does actually shave off his hair and beard, puts on the yellow robe, and then he does eventually go forth from home life into homelessness as a consequence of that. Next part here now, we are starting to get into the virtue aspect of the Noble Eightfold Path. So we have now been seeing how the person goes forth, right? How they acquire right view, and how they aim in the right way by becoming a monastic. Sometimes people don't become monastics, and that's okay too. And then you aim in the right way through being a householder instead. That sometimes that is too difficult to go forth. It just doesn't fit with one's lifestyle. And then you try to practice the Dhamma to the best of your ability as a householder. It is very important when people go forth and decide to become monastics that it happens quite naturally, that you don't force these things too much. Sometimes people have this super ultra idealistic, yes, I want to become a monastic, but it doesn't really come from the heart. It comes instead from some kind of idea in your mind. Yeah, this is the right thing to do. But you haven't really fully it's not really fully coming from the right place. So you have to be a little bit careful about that. And if for those people who are interested in being monastics, I would always recommend you, first of all, to try to stay in a monastery for a while and see if it actually works for you. Check it out, because the reality of monasticism is often quite different from the theory. Sounds great in theory, but the reality can often be quite quite hard, right? And quite difficult to bear. And especially what you often find, of course, it depends a lot on which monasteries you go to. Monasteries are often very different. So I would always recommend people to try out a few different monasteries to find a place that is suitable for you, where you feel natural, where you feel at ease, and you feel that it is going in the kind of right direction. Because sometimes you may come to a place and it doesn't really feel right for you. It doesn't really feel that you are kind of, this is what you want to be doing. One of the important things in monastic life, you find that monasteries are very different. One of the problems in monastic life can be too much focus on tiny little aspects of the vinaya, of the code of conduct, often rules that have been laid down in the commentaries and laid down in a particular monastery. And one of the dangers in monastic life is that often it can either, monastic life, people are too slack and they don't keep the rules that the Buddha laid down, or they become incredibly strict and they keep all kinds of rules that are really irrelevant to monastic life, and they become very fault-finding. This is the danger with rules, right? You become very fault-finding of other people. If somebody else doesn't keep the rules, you think, ah, terrible person, what are you doing? And you cannot tell them off in harsh terms. And you forget that in Buddhism, the Dhamma is the source. The Dhamma is what really matters. And Dhamma is always about kindness and compassion. And the rules are secondary. The rules also come from that same Dhamma, but they should always be kept and be acted upon in the context of kindness and compassion. So sometimes when a monastery becomes a little bit too harsh, because there's too much focus on the rules, then you lose the Dhamma. You gain rules, but you lose the Dhamma. You can almost see what we're talking about before. There are fewer arahants in the world, but more rules, right? And the more rules there are, the more easily it is to become fault-finding and see the problems. And this is one of the things that I have always, respect so much, is somebody like Ajahn Brahm. Ajahn Brahm is not really all that concerned. He doesn't really look at the monks all that much to see whether they are keeping the rules or not. If they don't keep the rules, he will tell them if there are important rules of the vinaya itself. But he's not somebody who kind of fault finds with you, right? He may give a Dhamma talk about doing the right thing, living in the right way, but then he stands back and allows you to keep the rules in the right way. He leaves it in large part up to the monastics to keep the rules. Of course, we teach the vinaya, we teach the young monks what to do, but we don't fault find so much. And when you have that kind of monastery, it becomes very pleasant to live there, because people are generally kind to each other, right? In our monastery, we don't have any arguments, really. We never really have arguments with each other. And it's very rare to live in a society 30 people living together, and there is no arguments. And it's very beautiful, because that harmony is very often the basis and the foundation you need for meditation practice to work. If you don't have harmony as the foundation, meditation and practice of the Buddhist path becomes incredibly hard and very difficult, because your mind is in turmoil if you argue too much with other people. So this is like the ideal, in my opinion, for a good monastery, where there is that kindness between people. There's inspiration. There's enough room for your own practice. There's enough kind of space to go back to Kuti and look after your own practice when you want to. These are some of the things here. So this is one of the ways of finding out whether monastic life is for you. You have to test out a few different monasteries. And if it isn't possible for you to live monastic life, then you kind of approach as far as you can the monastic ideal in lay life, right? By living to the best of your ability. And when you do that, you can go a long way if you are really committed and sincere. And this is the hardest part in the Buddhist teaching, is to have that commitment and sincerity and perseverance on the path. But if you really have that commitment, then you can go a long way, whether you are a lay person or monastic. That commitment is really the important part here. When you then have this right aim, right, you have gone forth, then, of course, comes all the morality and the moral parts that you have to practice as a consequence of that. I will stop there for now, because now we are kind of moving into a different area again. I don't want to overload these talks with too much, otherwise we're going to something is going to go wrong, I think. So we have to be careful with ourselves, out of compassion for myself and also out of compassion for you. I will not go any further right now. So I will see you back again at 4:45, and then we'll have some meditation and do the Q&A afterwards.